Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Fraser Nelson. So last night's Valentine's Day massacre turned out to be bloody after all, as the government lost by 45 votes on its main Brexit motion. James, what does it mean?
Well, it doesn't mean anything in legal terms, but I think in terms of Theresa May's negotiating position, it leaves her weaker. After she passed the Brady Amendment, or she won the Brady Amendment, the government backed it, it passed House of Commons. She went back to the EU and tried to say, look, this is what will pass the Commons, I need changes. The EU reaction was essentially, oh, it's a one-off vote, it's not a stable majority, how do we know it'll hold together? The fact that 2 weeks later she's lost a vote in the House of Commons will, to their mind, prove that they were right. They will say, no, it's not going to work. Even if we gave you something on the backstop, it wouldn't get it through. So why don't you do a deal with Jeremy Corbyn on the lines that he's suggested, this customs union, which the EU would quite like, and that's the way to get it through Parliament. I think it leaves her in a weaker negotiating position than she was before.
But to be cynical about this, some people will be saying that the ERG voted against her motion because of the Spelman-Dromey amendment that also passed at the same time. So could she say something like, well, actually, Brady still stands?
I think she will try and say that the only thing the House of Commons has voted for is Brady. And she'd be right on that. But her position, I think, is undercut by the fact that the EU will say, oh, but the EU line on Brady as well, but Brady only passed because it meant so many different things to different people, etc. I also think this line about what the government motion said about Spelman, I don't think in any of the capitals of Europe that they would have taken this motion last night passing as somehow proof or evidence that the UK government had taken no deal off the table.
So Fraser, how are you feeling about Brexit negotiations and how it's going after the brief respite we had?
Well, I think we've seen a little flourish of entertainment. I'm not sure it'll make that much of a difference. The question is whether Theresa May really is genuinely negotiating right now or whether she's playing for time, as Keir Starmer keeps saying. And I think Keir Starmer is right. I mean, the two sides are actually quite close together. We say in the leading article of The Spectator this week that all the EU need to do is to agree a standard kind of exit clause in the withdrawal agreement and it would pass Parliament. So the ERG, all of these fire-breathing Tory rebels would actually vote for Theresa May's deal as long as they thought it was a bridge to something else. Mm. They'd accept it for 2 years or 3 years. They'd accept paying Brussels money. They would accept not having any say over these laws as long as they felt that after 2 or 3 years there might be a trade deal. Their concern is that we do this and there might never be a trade deal. The bridge might become the resting place. Now, given that the EU says, no, don't worry, we don't want this resting place, this backstop either, you wouldn't think it'd be much for the EU to say, let's have an exit clause, because most treaties in the world have exit clauses. So they remain close. But does the EU really want to do that, or is it holding out for something more? It's holding out for something more. Theresa May is holding out for something more. The ERG are holding out for something more. Everybody thinks that by running down the clock, by having a last-minute discussion, they're more likely to get what they want. This is the pattern of behaviour that James was the first to outline 3 or 4 months ago. Now, people believing that the more greater the panic, the more likely they are to get what they want. I suspect Theresa May's fantasy is to have Parliament backing her deal after all, there being some kind of pathetic concession from the EU, and then Parliament then taking that concession as an excuse to back Theresa May. So she could say, OK, you guys have basically admitted your error of your ways and you're going to back me, even though the EU haven't given anything substantive. That's what she thinks. The ERG think they're going to get a concession, and who knows? So I'm not sure last night really moved the dial.
No.
We are pretty much where we were last week.
One other way in which I think last night did move the dial, I think it weakened her negotiating position. I also think it makes it more likely that Cooper 2 will pass when it comes back to the House of Commons. If Cooper 2 passes, that would then mean that if the EU and the UK have not come to an agreement by the middle of March, so e.g. before that council, so you can't take it to the council for a last minute kind of rundown, Theresa May would be compelled to ask for an extension. At that point, I think the extension that the EU comes back offering is much longer than people are broadly expecting.
So something like longer than 12 months or?
I think 21 months, that kind of length of time. And I think for that reason, That will then be essentially the choice that Ollie Robbins outlined in that Brussels bar, which is MPs will have to choose between May's deal and a very lengthy extension. I think what they do in that circumstance is an interesting question.
And Fraser, one idea that's been reported on this week is this idea of a six-month review of the backstop. Would something like that be good enough for...
I think that's what I'm referring to when I say some meaningless concession.
Right.
What is a review, really? Two people can agree to review anything they want. Unless the review has got the ability for one party to serve notice on the other, then it's meaningless. But might that be the kind of thing that the ERG would back if this game of chicken were to go Theresa May's way? I think so. I mean, I'm not saying they would back it, but if they were to back down, it would be over something like that.
Right, now, so spoken, give them some cover.
Yeah, some cover, if they basically were to admit defeat. Now, in the last few days, I've spoken to quite a few cabinet members, and I ask my favourite question, what's your gut feeling tell you? Where do you think this will end? Not where you want it to end, but where will it end? And most of the people I've spoken to have said that they think it will end in this way, with the EU granting some token, some Potemkin kind of concession, and other MPs using this as an excuse to back Theresa May.
Today we also heard that Steve Barclay has been talking to Michel Barnier about not renegotiating the withdrawal agreement, but about getting some kind of assurance on the backstop without doing that. Does that change our position at all, that he's not asking for reopening it?
Well, Dex, you deny that this is what he's asking for. I think this is a whole question of whether it's a codicil or whether it's in the agreement itself. Personally, I think in terms of reopening the agreement, normally the problem with reopening international agreements is that parliaments around the place have started ratifying them. That hasn't happened in this place. You know, and it is worth remembering that the backstop is contained in a protocol within the agreement. I really don't think in the 21st century it's beyond, you know, beyond the wit of man to add another par or two onto a protocol. I mean, that's essentially what you're talking about. And yes, it would require the 27 EU leaders to gather together to approve that exercise. And people say, oh, yes, immediately the Spanish would demand Gibraltar, they demand this, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, but it's not the same as having to go back to 27 national parliaments and say, oh, you've all ratified this, but we've made a change, so you're going to have to start the process again. It's not as dramatic as that. You know, yes, the withdrawal agreement is closed, but it's not closed in a kind of way that has legal meaning.
And also, let's remember that the EU did this with Canada. The Canada trade deal had to be approved amongst various parliaments. They then bolted on another amendment to it, and that didn't need to be.
But that wasn't in the text itself. But I think that was different because they had started going through the ratification process in other parliaments.
And James, the government is facing another conundrum this week about what to do over Shamima Begum, the teenage jihadi bride who left Bethnal Green a few years ago to join ISIS. What do you think?
So I don't think you should risk the lives of British service personnel or diplomatic personnel to get her back from this refugee camp.
And she's
camp.
In Syria refugee camp with no
But I mean, if she reached Turkey and reached out for consular support, I think she should be offered that consular support, because I personally think we should want her to come back to this country and be investigated, and I suspect, and I think given the evidence, I suspect she would be prosecuted for what she is alleged to have done. I think that this idea, she was 15, not 5, not 11, I think that, you know, and she went to ISIS territory at a time when people knew what ISIS was. This was not a time when people could think that they were some kind of, you know, national liberation movement and a benign force. It was quite clear what they were up to, the slaughter of the Yazidis, I mean, genocide even of the Yazidis, and the sheer brutality of the regime. And I think that if she reached out for consular support, she should be offered it, she should be brought back, but crucially, she should be prosecuted, because it appears, not to legally register, but it appears that she has broken the bonds of citizenship.
Mm. And Fraser, interestingly, she says she doesn't regret doing any of this. She's not repentant at all. So, I mean, yes, she was 15 when she left, but she's 19 now, and she was probably still do things the same way. What do you think of, I mean, does that make a difference to you?
Well, I think it does make a difference. It's one thing if she's saying, look, I was brainwashed, I now see the error of my ways, I was just a schoolgirl then, I'm so sorry, take me back. Now she's talking about how she's quite cheerfully looking at beheaded heads in the bin, and she thinks, well...
Well, she said she wasn't fazed.
She wasn't fazed, but she also said that I thought what they would have done to Muslim girls. In other words, she basically felt that these people who were beheaded deserved their fate. Now, if that's the way she sees the world, it's not exactly the most enticing prospectus to have her back in Britain, where she is quite heavily radicalised, quite heavily brainwashed.
So do you think she should come back?
Well, of course, I do think she should come back, but subject to all the various strictures of the law. I mean, there is a sort of temptation to think, well, now the war on ISIS is over, we should now effectively see her as a kind of Joyce Emily Hammond figure. You know, that's one of the girls in Miss Jean Brodie's school who went off to fight in the Spanish Civil War. You know, the classic example of the romantic schoolgirl who got the wrong idea in her head. But then again, it wasn't so long ago that anybody who gave the IRA succor in their various campaigns was treated to the full force of the law. She's an adult now and ought to come back. And I don't think you can, there isn't much of a case for granting her immunity. Now, this is a major conundrum with the government, don't get me wrong. There are hundreds of foreign fighters in this camp, which has been run by the Kurds. So Britain, the Netherlands, America, all these countries are now facing the question of what to do with these people, how to rehabilitate them. Do we have the facilities to keep track of all of them? Of course we don't. If you do take them back, what are the odds? And say you take 100 back, if one of them then goes on to commit an atrocity, then the government will not be forgiven by the people. So this is a massive problem, but one the government is going to have to get its heads around.
And Fraser, do we know how the government is going to react from this conundrum? Have we heard any noises from there?
Well, Ben Wallace has been out saying he hasn't got any sympathy, that this should be dealt with formally. And Sajid Javid is pretty hardline on this. I mean, remember, he decided to let the US authorities prosecute the Beatles, the so-called Beatles, as a core of jihadis who were found to have committed some pretty major atrocities, even if that meant they faced the death penalty. That was a big decision for Britain, because normally we do not allow America to take anybody who they might then execute. So right now, Theresa May's government, if there is such a thing really, if this loose, warring, feuding bunch of ministers can be called a government, is pretty hard line on returning jihadis, no matter what gender they might be and no matter how pregnant they might be.
James and Fraser, thanks very much. And if you'd like to subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for £12, you can get a free £10 Amazon voucher if you go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.